Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Angela Byrne. Angela is passionate about sharing her knowledge and experience and ultimately helping others to succeed. She is president of Angela Byrne Consulting, a practice located in St. Mary's, Ontario, Canada, dedicated to working with organizations to manage risks to achieving strategic objectives. Angela has over 30 years of practical experience working with a variety of organizations. She is a chartered professional accountant, a certified management accountant, and holds certifications in risk management assurance, internal audit, and information systems auditing. Thanks so much for joining Tolerable Risk today, Angela. We're so happy you're here.
Thanks, Sabrina. I'm happy to be here too.
So for those in our audience that aren't familiar with you and your background, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the risk area, and what you've been working on lately?
Yes. So as you mentioned, I'm from Canada. So I live in St. Mary's, which is a small town in southwestern Ontario. We're about 2 hours west of Toronto, and I'm here with my husband, Jeff, and we have three cats. So he's the cat lover, not me, which is often what people think when they see the three cats come out of the house. One of the things that I'm doing in my spare time is I'm learning to fly a small plane. And what's most interesting about that is that it's really highlighted for me the parallels in terms of managing risk in an organization and also risk in the field of aviation. I'm also a volunteer board member for the Friends of St. Mary's Museum, and I sit as a member of the Compliance Audit Committee for our local municipal elections. I started consulting in 2000, and prior to that, I worked for the provincial government. The way I got into risk management is that over the 22 years I've been consulting, I have been fortunate to work with over 45 organizations, mostly in the social services area, providing supports to children and families. And what I saw in that sector was a lot of struggle with the back office functions within an organization, particularly in the financial end of things. And I've come to appreciate that basically how you manage risk shows up in all parts of your organization, and particularly how you manage the financial aspects of the organization can, at the end of the day, affects your decision-making throughout everything that you do within the organization.
What an amazing background, Angela. You're learning how to fly in airplanes for a risk person. I guess it's pretty exciting. And that's great to hear. You also had experience, then you said, in working for the government in Canada. And in that role, you have interacted with a lot of charities and nonprofits.
Yes, yes. So in my role with government, I essentially wrote proposals for funding for social service agencies. And I also worked as an internal auditor in the court system and the jail system as well. Risks from various perspectives.
So because you have this great wealth of experience working with charities and nonprofits, particularly, I mean, gosh, writing funding proposals, that's probably one of the hardest things that you have to do in an organization. When it comes to risk, can you talk a little bit about how risk is viewed in the third sector, and particularly what is embraced and what is rejected?
So risk management in the third sector certainly has evolved sort of over the last 20 years. Probably 20 years ago when I started consulting, there was very little attention paid to risk. If there was any attention paid to it, it was mostly from a compliance perspective. So that is shifting somewhat. What's rejected, I guess, is there's a significant barrier in the third sector to investing in developing a risk management practice within the organization. And that's certainly about a preference to use any funding to deliver service. So what I try to do is help organizations understand the benefit of risk management, which is essentially making better decisions within the organization.
So can you talk a little bit about that from your experience working with private sector and government organizations, as opposed to working with third sector? Where are some of the differences, and what are the things that third sector organizations should be thinking about when they think risk? Particularly, I like what you just said, to influence decision making.
So for the private and government sector, there certainly seems to be a greater appreciation for the need for a strong infrastructure to support the sustainability of the organization. There's less of that appreciation, in my experience, with the third sector. Most private and government sectors have some form of risk management in place. How effective it is could be questionable. However, there is a less of a willingness to change the risk management or make it more effective unless there's great dissatisfaction with what they're getting. In contrast, the focus of the third sector, I try to demonstrate how strong risk management practices can really provide value for money because it can enhance credibility with key stakeholders such as government funders and donors. I use an approach which is objective-centric, risk uncertainty management approach, and it's the most effective approach that I have found in my experience because everything's rooted to an objective. But educating people, whether it's the private sector or the third sector, starts at different points.
You mentioned that a lot of times when people approach risk, the focus is on compliance. Can you talk a little bit about, for people in our audience who may still be very new to what is risk, what is risk management? What are some differences between risk and compliance?
So if risk is viewed as a compliance exercise, it's typically disconnected from any objective. It's typically a checklist process. And the danger in that is that it could provide a false sense of assurance that you are managing risks within the organization, but you're not really, because things could go awry and you haven't even thought about how you would respond to that risk or how it would derail your organization. So the compliance exercise is, the danger is in the providing a false sense of assurance, in my opinion, and thinking that you're managing risk when in fact you're not.
Yeah, I find that a lot of times people say, well, I have my checklist and so I'm managing risk. But in reality, what that checklist is doing is helping you be in compliance, which isn't a bad thing, but it's not really helping you manage risk.
No. So for example, I had a discussion with a not-for-profit where they were checking compliance to all their policies and procedures, and that's what they considered to be their risk practice. Well, there was nothing to determine whether those policies and procedures were actually mitigating the risk that they were intended to mitigate and that they were actually doing any good for the organization. So you could be checking off that you've got all these things in place, but whether they're effective or not is another exercise altogether.
Definitely. Can you talk a little bit more about the objective-centric approach that you use and maybe talk a little bit about how a small to medium-sized, low-resource, no-resource organization could move towards objective-centric risk management? And just for those who are listening out there who may not be familiar with the objective-centric approach, we're talking about objective-centered certainty and risk management that has really been pioneered and shared by Tim Leach. You can find a lot more about this approach by following Tim Leach on LinkedIn and reading some of his writings.
Yeah. So the objective-centric approach really is the one that I find is most effective for the third sector. Well, in any situation, I don't use any other approach now. It's basically the one I believe in. This is the one that I've seen be effective. And essentially, it at the 30,000 foot view, it's really linking everything that you do with risk to an objective. So it starts with picking the most important objectives for your organization and then looking at the risk or what can get in the way of achieving that objective, and then deciding what you're going to do about that. Deciding if you have stuff in place that already mitigates that risk or whether you have action that you need to take. So it's always keeping the objective sort of front and center when you think about risk. And the reason it works so well, what I consider to be value for money for the third sector, is that you're being very selective about how you're using your resources. So you're not auditing and checking and double checking everything within the organization, looking for risks in general. You're essentially focusing on the handful of objectives that are most important for the organization to succeed. And then you're looking at the risks that could get in the way of those objectives. So it narrows the focus and it makes, in my opinion, the best use of limited resources in terms of focusing your efforts on the most important things within the organization.
Angela, could you give some examples of how nonprofits have applied objective-centric risk management?
So typically they start with phasing it in over a period of time, selecting the most important objectives. And the management level at a not-for-profit, they know what are the most important things that they need to get done to be successful in their organization or in their field in delivering their service. So it's looking at those pulling together a team approach in terms of identifying the objectives and then spending some time in a facilitated session identifying what can get in the way of achieving that objective. The facilitated session, the group perspective is very important because you want a variety of opinions to make sure that you're identifying the key risks and sometimes what we all get sort of tunnel vision. So you want to make sure that you have varying perspectives in order to allow people to think about sort of outside the box and what can get in the way. And there's a number of tools that are available to help people think beyond what's top of mind in terms of risks. Because often that's what sidelines organizations. It's not the risk that you're prepared for. It's the risk that we didn't see coming. So we've all experienced that after the last 2 years of the pandemic.
Absolutely. Those known unknowns and unknown unknowns that come at you sideways and you don't know what to do or how to respond. Well, let me ask you, so after a facilitated session, when the organization leadership or management or whoever it is coming together and talking about the most important objectives, what is the output from that session then? And then how do organizations monitor and measure and make sure that great session that they had where they identified their objectives, they identified anything that's going to prevent them from achieving those objectives? What do they do then?
So essentially, what I recommend is that there's a committee formed. So either you can call it a risk committee if you want, or some committee at a senior level in terms of looking at what we call an objective register and monitoring that. Typically, you can do quarterly. The easiest way to do this for not-for-profits or charities is really to sort of embed it in your regular decision-making. So in one case, what we did was we amended board reporting and we aligned the board reports with the risk information that's needed at the board level and had a more detailed level at the senior management level. And then integrated that with the board reporting that was going on anyway. And that just makes a lot of sense for an organization. So we're not adding on or creating a whole different process within the organization. We're integrating it with what they're doing currently and also integrating it with any strategic planning exercises to make sure that the risks are identified during that process as well. What you end up with is essentially a monitoring tool that you can use quarterly. You can sift through that and pull out what's most relevant to the board and to make sure that they're aware of the risks that could possibly get in the way of the objectives, and most importantly, what management is doing about that.
It's interesting you said it's an objective register, not a risk register. What's the difference?
So in my experience with risk registers, they're often a list of risks, but it's not clear how that risk relates to the objectives of the organization. And when you have that disconnect between the objective, then the usefulness of risk management in terms of making decisions diminishes. Because if it's a risk that is general, then what action do you take in terms of making sure it doesn't affect your objective? The other thing that's built into the objective-centric risk approach is an objective owner. So rather than, in some cases, I've seen some organizations assign risk owners. However, in this approach, we have an objective owner. So it's up to the objective owner to be accountable for the success of that objective.
Yeah, I'm also an objective-centered fan, as people who have read things I've written on LinkedIn know, because I think it really puts your head in the right place. Instead of trying to manage a long list of terrible things that may or may not happen, you're really all focused on achieving the objectives of the organization. And if you're monitoring your objective certainty, then by default, you're monitoring your risks because you won't be able to march towards achieving that objective if the risks are in the way. Now, some people don't like this approach because they think that it's too qualitative. It's not quantitative enough. What are your thoughts on quantitative versus qualitative risk management? And for people who are listening, quantitative risk management is running scenarios, Monte Carlo simulations, things like that, things that take your probabilities and map them out versus a qualitative approach, which may be more human-centric, taking into account individuals' knowledge of operating environments or past performance. So, Angela, what are your thoughts on qualitative versus quantitative?
So the quantitative methodologies still have a place, but it can be very selective in terms of how you use that information. So for your Monte Carlo simulations, you can still run those against your objectives or and against your risks. I've worked with insurance companies in the past, and those quantitative simulations are part and parcel of how they manage risk. But it's only one piece of the puzzle, because typically all your quantitative analysis is based on historical information, right? So there's still a place for that qualitative perspective as well. And there's also the risk of getting lost in your analysis and not doing anything about anything while you're trying to achieve your objective.
Analysis paralysis is what I've called it in the past. But it's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned you worked with quantitative approaches with the insurance companies, but those companies have reams and reams and reams of data and databases, and they have all this historical data and the clean and verified data that they can put into these scenarios. What are your thoughts about third sector, small, medium-sized nonprofits' ability to use quantitative tools? Are there any tools out there that you could recommend with the knowledge that maybe historical data might not be at their fingertips?
No. Nothing that would have the rigor that some of the quantitative tools have. In the objective-centric approach I use, you can use performance indicators to give you an indication as to if you're on the right path of achieving the objective, which is very important to be able to measure your progress as you move forward. But unless you're doing research and studies, I'm not sure what else you would use in that case.
Yeah, I agree with you, Angela. I've been looking to try and see if there are quantitative tools that nonprofits could use to supplement for a little bit more assurance, maybe in their risk management, something like objective-centered risk management. But I've had a hard time finding any that might be useful for a charity or a nonprofit that doesn't have, again, that historical, clean and verified data to feed into these things. So it sounds like we third sector folks are still going to be relying on the knowledge of our teams, the expertise of our implementers and our past performance, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think there's a lot of really great risk management that can be done without quantitative tools.
And you need to keep in mind that the purpose of risk management is to make better decisions and achieve your objective. I would rather trade off moving more quickly than slowing down to do a lot of analysis, I guess, is my perspective. Because you can always come back and track. If you have good performance indicators, those should be the red flags to tell you that you're not achieving your objective or you're not on path. You've stepped off your path and now you need to course correct in order to move. And that triggers a look at your risks again, quite frankly. So it's, what are you doing and is that being effective in terms of mitigating the risk?
Yeah, that's great. So for small to medium-sized organizations, again, that may not have a lot of resources, they may not have a dedicated risk management person. It might be the finance and administrative manager's fourth hat that they have to wear. How could leadership and management better engage in this theme and support risk management within an organization? I think we all know that the answer would be more resources. And of course, that's what everybody would want. But if they don't have these additional resources, what are some good ways for leadership and management to really start integrating this objective-centered risk-based approach into the ways of working of the organization?
So my suggestion would be to not get too hung up on trying to have a dedicated risk department. I think it's quite acceptable to embed that risk management practice within your executive committee or your senior management team, and then use it as part of your decision making. So essentially, make sure that every time you meet, everyone is on board about what the priority objectives are, who owns those objectives, where are you in achieving that objective? What are the key risks and what are you doing about that? It can be a very sort of succinct conversation in terms of this is where we're going, this is what's getting in the way, this is what we're doing about it. And that embedding it in your daily practices or decision-making is probably the most effective way to manage the risks.
I really like that. I like that thinking of tying risk management to decision-making, because I think it's something when you say it, you're like, oh yeah, well, that makes sense. But it's not something, there's not dots that people would connect when they immediately think of risk management. So I think that's a great point. Figuring out how you make sure that your risk management structure, whatever it is tied to decision making. That's a really great way of thinking. The other thing I like that you've been talking a lot about, Angela, is this concept of accountability, where each objective has an objective owner and those people are accountable. Can you talk a little bit more about accountability in risk management? And also, I know at least some people might be thinking that accountability in some organizations is simply an excuse for people to point fingers when there's failures. How can people think about accountability with risk without being afraid of it?
Well, that's a really good point, because if you're really for risk management to be effective in decision making, you need to be candid about the level of risk you're willing to accept. And that's part and parcel of why you want an objective owner, because the objective owner is accountable for the success of the objective, but they are also the person that determines what is an acceptable risk to take in achieving that objective. Now, part of the objective-centric approach is to have transparency around that risk acceptance decision. So you would have a provision to override the objective owner if you felt that they were taking the organization in a dangerous route. However, an objective owner should have that prerogative to decide how much risk they're willing to accept in achieving the objective.
What are your thoughts about risk appetite statements?
Oh, dear.
I love it. I think that's all we needed to hear. Oh, dear. Go ahead.
People really like to have them in place. They're very difficult. The actual risk statements are very difficult to write. And to put them into practice is... yeah, it's just, I don't know why people like them, but it's a false sense of assurance again, in my perspective. I haven't seen any risk appetite statements that are really effective and that really improve decision making. So if you believe that risk management is about making decisions, then you have to wonder why you need the risk appetite statements.
I love it. Oh dear. That's the best way to respond to risk appetite statements. I agree. I think a lot of times the risk appetite statements are something that may have been generated because a board member had read it in an article somewhere, or maybe a funder asked to see it, and then the organization frantically runs around and tries to write one. But you're right. I have really never seen a risk appetite statement that has contributed to decision making. It's something that is written, the organization pats itself on the back, it gets up on a shelf, and no one ever looks at it again. So what's the point?
Well, and they become so generic. Like, yeah, we're not going to, it'll be something like, we're going to break any laws. And it's like, well, okay. There's different ways of getting at that, right? You know, from the organization culture, the ethical behavior of your employees. I don't know that putting that down in a risk appetite statement is that helpful, quite frankly.
I am in agreement with you there. So we've sort of been dancing a little bit around the role of boards. We've mentioned it a few times, but let's talk about that. So if you are advising a small to medium-sized organization, if you're advising their board members in particular, what would be three questions that you would suggest to them, the board members, that they should be asking about risks relating to the organization that they are responsible for overseeing?
So I think if the board is being given a list of risks, the one question as a board member that I would ask is, how is this important to the organization and how does it affect the objectives of the organization? Because boards need to know in terms of what is getting in the way of their strategy, what can send the organization down a wrong path type of thing. The boards also need to know what management is doing in response to risk. And they need to know the level of any type of assurance work that's being conducted within the organization. So is the CEO coming to you and to the board and saying, everything is good within the organization? Well, how do they know? What kind of assurance do they have that everything is working as intended? And then the board should be educated in risk management as well. Ideally, the objective-centric risk management approach, and know what they need to ask to have an understanding of what information they want to be put in front of the board members in terms of risks within the organization. And ideally, I support a board report that identifies the objectives, the high-level objectives of the organization, the key risks that management has identified, and what they're doing about it, and updating that on a regular basis.
How far into the weeds, at what level should the information in the reports for the boards be at? What would you recommend is the appropriate volume and depth for a board report? And the reason I'm asking this is because if I'm a board member, I want to make sure I'm getting what I need and not necessarily just what's being put in front of me. So what would you recommend for a board member that thinks maybe I need more information? What should they be expecting in these reports?
In my opinion, I favor a very succinct, like one-page report to the board. Here are the objectives, here are the key risks, this is what we're doing, and their objective certainty around how confident they are that they're going to achieve that objective. In terms of questions for the board to ask of the CEO and management is really around delving a little bit into how effective their actions are, what they've seen change since the last report, what are the emerging risks that may not be on the report that could be getting in the way of the objective, and what they anticipate their response will be going forward. And so it's from that conversation the board should get a good sense as to whether the CEO and management are thinking ahead and whether they're anticipating and they have some kind of plan in place and that they're monitoring sort of things that can get in the way of the objective.
Those are some excellent questions. I think those are great things, particularly for new-ish board members of third sector organizations to keep in mind. Those are great. Thanks so much for those, Angela. I want to go back a little bit to the discussion about availability of resources. And again, your background having experience writing funding proposals is really helpful here. How can small and medium-sized charities and nonprofits justify source requests in proposals for risk management or just even improving their operational functions and internal controls? Because a lot of times when you put in a line item for maybe continuing staff training or for risk management or for updated software or platforms, a lot of times those are the first things to get a red line from a funder. So what would be some really compelling arguments that third sector organizations could use to secure some of this funding?
So the one thing I would look at is their history of success in achieving their objectives and underscoring the value of risk management and its impact on their decisions in achieving their success. So that would be how I would frame it in terms of looking at funding for training in risk management. I don't think it's necessary to hire a risk person within or position within the organization. I think it's better to have risk shared at a committee level, at the executive level, and then take resources into training everybody throughout the organization, making it everybody's responsibility.
So there's a saying that says if it's everybody's responsibility, it's nobody's responsibility. So risk by committee, I think with what you're saying is because we want risk management to be so integrated into the ways that the organization is working that you don't necessarily need to have one person who is the risk manager with their hat on. But a lot of times with small organizations, if it's by committee, then everyone is looking at somebody else to do it. So what would be good ways if they're going to take the committee approach to ensure that risk doesn't just get pushed to the side or becomes a compliance exercise without having that one person who's responsible for driving its prioritization?
So the drivers become the objective owners. So even though the discussion is at a committee level and you want that diverse perspective from the other committee members about your objective and the risks that you've identified, the objective owner is still held accountable for achieving that objective.
That's very interesting. So you still have the accountability there because if they're not achieving their objectives, then obviously the risks are getting in the way. And therefore, the objective owners are the ones that would be then prioritizing risk management because they want to be able to meet their delivery.
Yes. So the objective owners report to the committee on the path of success, how they're achieving the objective, the risks that are getting in the way, what they're doing about it. And then the committee has an opportunity to basically have some discussion with the objective owner is, okay, does that make sense? the action that the objective owner is taking. Does the rest of the committee members, do they think that makes sense for the organization? Is the objective owner taking on too much risk in achieving the objective? So it's basically you've developed a sounding board at that executive level to question the objective owner. And then the committee at the executive level is also the group that would sift through the information and boil it down to what the board needs to know.
So then the committee is part of management then. It's not the risk committee of the board. It's a management team.
Yes.
So in a small organization, the risk committee in theory would contain objective owners, right? I mean, or is there—
Absolutely.
Okay. So there's really no need for it to be independent. It could be overlapping.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's an interesting approach, especially for under-resourced or low-resourced organizations to take. That's great. Risk is, I think, as we would agree, is dynamic. It's not static. It's always changing. So let me ask you, how do you stay on top of the changing information and trends in the area of risk management?
I belong to a number of professional associations, and I also seek out professional development opportunities to stay current with trends and emerging practices. Earlier this year, I completed the Not-for-Profit Governance Essentials course by the Institute of Corporate Directors here in Canada, which I highly recommend for board members who are looking to sit on third sector boards. It was a really good overview, including perspectives around risk management. And then I also share my learnings through articles and presentations and that type of thing, and receive lots of feedback around that.
That's great. So for low to no resource organizations, can you suggest any other platforms or continuing education opportunities for people who want to learn more about risk management in general, about objective-centered risk management? What are some resources out there that these organizations or individuals could access so that they can do continuing education and learn more themselves?
So for the objective-centric risk and certainty management approach that I use, Risk Oversight Solutions has a number of free resources. And then the other good resource is C-Risk Academy, and they have a lot of training, which seems to be a reasonable cost and at different various price points as well. So there's longer sessions, shorter sessions. I found their resources are quite good, and they also have free podcasts as well around risk.
That's great. I know that risk is something that third sector organizations have managed. They just haven't really documented it. And so now with a lot of the demands by funders and donors to get better at documentation, it's becoming more top of mind for a lot of organizations. So those resources are going to be super helpful. Thanks for those suggestions, Angela. So just to wrap up here with any final thoughts, is there anything that you want to add to the conversation today that you think is really important for folks within charities and nonprofits to think about generally when it comes to risk management for their organizations?
Well, I know that funding is often cited as a barrier to risk management, but the one thing to keep in mind is that all organizations are already managing risk informally. All you're doing is formalizing it so you can demonstrate accountability and that you have a more structured approach to making good decisions or effective decisions. And my personal opinion is that the future success of the organizations in the third sector really depends on effective risk management in order to make good decisions. And the services that the third sector delivers are too important to our way of life to lose those organizations. So the more that we can support the third sector in making good decisions, the better off we all are.
I think that's great. Again, taking it back to decision making. And I just think that's such a wonderful way to think about it. If we really have to distill risk management down to a very simple concept, it's informing better decisions. That's brilliant. Thanks so much, Angela. So if people are really interested in learning more about the work that you do and contacting you, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
So they can contact me at info@angelaburncma.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn at angelaburncma and my website as well.
Great. So thank you so much for your time today, Angela. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I think it's going to be really, really helpful for folks in the third sector. So thanks for your time.
Good. Thank you, Sabrina.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.